Hello, my name is Adrian Goldberg and welcome to the Byline Times podcast. The Byline Times, it's what the papers don't say, what radio doesn't report and what telly doesn't tell you. This time towards a Palestinian state. The Foreign Secretary, Lord Cameron, has said that rather than waiting for a successful outcome of peace talks in the Middle East, the UK government would consider the idea of a Palestinian state during negotiations. This is a subtle but significant shift in emphasis. The idea, said Cameron, is to give the Palestinian people a political horizon, a route to statehood without having to resort to violence. The initiative has been welcomed by the Palestinian mission in London, and the idea of a two-state solution is also supported by the United States, but has been rejected by the Israeli government. This comes, of course, following more than 135 days of fighting, triggered by the atrocity of October the 7th, in which 1,139 Israelis died and around 250 of its citizens were taken hostage. 25,000 people in Gaza have since been killed in Israel's counter-offensive as it seeks to eradicate Hamas. Hannah Weisfeld is from Yachad, a British Jewish organisation whose primary mission is to empower British Jews to support a political resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. How significant does she think Cameron's intervention is?
Well, I was actually there when he made the comments, and it was interesting because I think people were expecting him to make some cursory remarks along the lines of this is what the British government thinks. And as he carried on speaking, you could see that people in the room suddenly started to really kind of pay attention to what he was saying, because it is really a significant shift. Because up until now, the British government's position has been that the end goal is a Palestinian state, but actually recognition of that state is the end of the process. So the point at which there is a deal on the table that has been signed by both parties, the UK government would recognise that state. What they're now saying is, as part of the way to bring the parties to the table to have the negotiation, we are prepared to at least think about the possibility of recognition of a Palestinian state as helping to put the people in the room to start with, you know. And so it's rather than it becoming the end point, it almost becomes the motivating, one of several motivating factors to get them around the table on the basis that it will give the Palestinian people some hope that there is actually a horizon that they're going to, as opposed to another set of failed negotiations.
Yeah, so essentially it's a carrot then, isn't it, for whoever is negotiating on the Palestinian side, something that says, look, if you go into these negotiations right from the outset, we're telling you that a Palestinian state is, we think, something that should be on the table early on in that process rather than at the very end of it.
Yeah, and I think that I think that sometimes what's slightly missing from the kind of commentary around it is that the point of that, you know, certainly from where I'm sitting, is it's partly about giving some confidence to the Palestinians that the international community is dead serious about getting to the end point, which is the Palestinian state. But equally, I think about giving the Palestinian Authority, as the elected representative body of the Palestinian people, some legitimacy. So it's about saying, if you're going to be a government that takes Palestine into statehood, we want you to be able to take back to the Palestinian people a sense that you can achieve something. Because actually, if you look at the dynamic of what's happening today on the ground, it's very easy to paint a different picture, which says the PA, as a ruling moderate, largely moderate force in Gaza, has achieved almost nothing for the Palestinian people. You know, and we can talk about where the blame lies for that, and they're not blameless, but it's certainly the case that non-violence has got them nothing. And today in the West Bank, there is significant settler violence, and actually there is a lot of land being annexed, and a sense that actually they are worse off as a result of that strategic decision. Whereas Hamas, there might be severe destruction of Gaza, but it will be able to spin a narrative, which is that we were incredibly violent, but at the end of this process, we managed to get Israel to release thousands of prisoners. And so part of this is about actually rewarding the Palestinian Authority and making them more legitimate in the eyes of the Palestinian people.
Do we know who the negotiations about this Palestinian state would be with? Would they be with the Palestinian Authority, which currently controls the West Bank? could they be with Hamas, who are currently in control in Gaza, albeit suffering the massive bombardment of the IDF?
Well, I mean, I think that's the kind of big question, because certainly from where Israel, and I would say the overwhelming, if not entirety of the Israeli public sits, there is nobody to talk to on Hamas. After the atrocities of October the 7th, Hamas have proved they are just not a partner. You know, and I don't think there is any trust amongst any Israeli that they could be a legitimate partner. The question then becomes, what happens to the PLO, which is the representative body of the Palestinian people, of which Fatah is part of it, and you know, Hamas is also representing there. What's the body, and the PA is effectively the government. Where does Hamas sit in it? And does the PA have an ability to say to Hamas, you can't be part of this conversation? You know, and I think that a lot of the conversation that's going on at the kind of international diplomatic level is about what desperately and urgently needs to happen to allow the PA to become a more legitimate ruling government in the eyes of the Palestinian people, and one that the Palestinian people want to be governed by, which is not necessarily the case on the ground at the moment. That a lot of people look at the PA as actually a moderate force that has failed to bring the Palestinian people anything and is also relatively corrupt. And so really, the onus is now on the international community to bolster the PA as much as they possibly can, so it can be the partner that sits around the table in these negotiations.
All of this presumes that Israel might be willing to enter a negotiation about a separate Palestinian state. Certainly, the current Israeli government has no intention of allowing that. So, in one sense, Lord Cameron is speaking at a very theoretical level, because it isn't only Hamas who might be seen as extremist in the circumstance, and we know that they are regarded as a terrorist organization by the international community, but the current Israeli government in this regard might be seen as extremist too, that they will have no truck with the concept of allowing a Palestinian state.
Yeah, I mean, it is absolutely the case that the current Israeli government has got very little or no interest in Palestinian statehood and is made up of people who have made it incredibly clear that they will do everything in their power to make it impossible for that to become a reality. That said, this current Israeli government is also deeply illegitimate in the eyes of many of the Israeli public. And so, you know, listeners might recall that until October the 6th, there were weekly protests with hundreds of thousands of Israelis out on the streets every single week protesting against this government and their extremism, which came to an end after October the 7th, but they are restarting. So there's literally just been an announcement today to say that this week the protests will restart in earnest. And those protests are against the Israeli government and its extremism on the basis that it's brought the Israeli people nothing, and it certainly hasn't brought them security. So it is possible that in the coming months, the coming year, we will see a different government in Israel. But in addition to that, I think the second part of this is that there are still steps that the international community can take to put the region on the path towards resolution. And so up until now, the international community has largely either ignored the conflict or kind of looked at it and said, well, we've got a government in Israel that's not interested in pursuing peace, and we've got extremists, and you know, it's certainly in Gaza that are interested in pursuing the opposite of peace. And actually, we don't have the right configuration, so let's just make sure the status quo kind of survives. What has been proved by the last very bloody 4 months is that the status quo is a complete disaster for Israelis and Palestinians. But it's actually terrible for the West too. So, you know, we are now, as the UK, embroiled in bombing Yemen as a result of this war. So it's not like our security is doing particularly well out of the war, that we as Brits will suffer economically, you know, our security will suffer. There is a motivation for the international community to solve this conflict, not just for the sake of the Israelis and the Palestinians, but actually for the sake of ourselves. And so there is a slightly different calculation. So the idea that the international community can wash its hands of the region and say the wrong people are in power, you know, and we've seen that in the last 2 weeks. So Cameron's comments about Palestinian statehood, which 2 days later there were leaks from the White House that they were also considering the same thing. I mean, that there's no way that that was not a coordinated effort. And just in the last week, an announcement from Biden with an executive order, which is quite a rare thing for a president to do, sanctioning violent settlers in the West Bank. And actually, if you read the content of that executive order, it's pretty far-reaching. So at the moment, there are four named violent settlers who are being sanctioned, but below the surface of those names is a sense that what Biden is trying to do is clamp down on the entire infrastructure and the financing of the infrastructure that is allowing settlers to kind of effectively run the Wild Bank like the Wild West, completely lawless with impunity. And that is, I think, a sign. Admittedly, it's a small one, but it is a sign that the international community is starting to understand that it has it in its power and in its gift to say there are red lines. And actually, there are red lines around behavior. There are red lines around where we're prepared to allow extremists on any side to take the region. And as much as it's in our gift as the international community, we're going to pull some of that back from the brink and send a very clear signal to both parties that the international community has expectations.
How far do you think the current Israeli government wants to see a one-state solution, which involves an expanded Israel? You've talked about settlers in the West Bank. In many cases, they've been protected by the IDF. And there's even a suggestion, certainly from some ministers in the current Israeli government, that as Israel pushes into Gaza, that this should not be a temporary measure, but that Israel should continue to expand into Gaza and that it should become part of a greater Israel. Is Israel after an expanded state, at least at government level?
The short answer is some of them are yes and some of them are no. So Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, who represents the very far right of the Israeli government, they are absolutely 100% in favor of a reoccupation of Gaza, which involves taking civilians back into the Gaza Strip. And actually, there was, I think last week, the week before, a conference in Jerusalem in which you saw members of the Israeli government, including them, leading a conference of Israelis talking about how they were going to reoccupy the Gaza Strip. And so there is definitely a wing of the government whose intention is to do that. I don't think, however, that that applies to the government as a whole, that there are forces which people will not think are moderate forces, but they are moderating forces on that extremism in the government. So you have people, for example, like Benny Gantz in the war cabinet. Benny Gantz is absolutely not in favor of a reoccupation, a civilian reoccupation of the Gaza Strip. And they are not in favor, people like Gantz, of a kind of permanent occupation of the West Bank, whether they're prepared to, I guess the terminology would be to deoccupy it, which is a big step, is a different question, but they're not necessarily ideologically committed to occupation in the way that the far-right extremists of the government are. So you have within that government a whole load of different people with slightly different motivations for being there. What I would say about the Prime Minister, about Netanyahu, is that it's certainly been the case for the last 12 months that most of the calculations he has made have largely been around himself and what he needs to maintain his own power and what he needs to stay out of prison, because he himself is facing trial for corruption. And there is a chance, in theory, that he could end up in jail. And so he is negotiating the pieces around a chessboard effectively to try and keep his coalition together, because without his coalition, there's a significant chance it falls. He's no longer the Prime Minister, and then he's facing a battle in court. And that's the point at which he personally is potentially not only no longer the Prime Minister, but he potentially ends up in prison. And so, will Bibi Netanyahu go along with a far right part of his cabinet who are pushing for civilian occupation of Gaza? Potentially, he might if he thinks it's going to keep himself out of prison. Does he personally support that? I mean, I think some people might be surprised by this analysis, but I think he probably isn't that interested actually in occupying Gaza long term.
The energy behind the support for Palestine resides, I think, in a sense of injustice, historical injustice, going back to the creation of Israel in 1948 and the Nakba, the forced removal of tens of thousands of Palestinians from their homes. Do you think that we can ever get peace in Israel and Gaza unless that is in some way addressed?
My sense is that for most Palestinians, that is right at the top of what they feel is justice in the peace agreement, which is what happens to people who were forcibly displaced, who left, who were removed, and whatever the terminology is that how people describe 1947 and 1948, and it was a mix of all of those things. But the bottom line is, at least 750,000 people were forced to leave their homes and never returned. That is now a much bigger population of, upwards of 5 million descendants of Palestinian refugees. And from Israel's perspective, the idea that the descendants of those 750,000 people return, Israel doesn't survive that as a Jewish state, basically. It effectively becomes a Palestinian state in which the Jews that are now living there become absorbed into that state. And so, at very face value, you have an intractable conflict, basically, in which there cannot be a resolution that both peoples can agree to. I think there is a different reality, which is more complicated than that, which is that, and I can't speak on behalf of, I mean, I can speak as a Jew that's very invested in this and spent over a decade working in the conflict. I can't speak on behalf of the people that will make the agreement on either side. But it's definitely the case that there is a reality that in any final status agreement, how the issue of return, the right of return, gets dealt with, and what the mechanism is for dealing with it is something that's got to be worked out incredibly carefully. And what compensation is involved and what recognition of the historical injustice it includes will all factor into a decision about what does or doesn't happen. I think that there is a reality today that there are two peoples living on this piece of land, both of whom claim national rights to it, both of whom who are not going anywhere. And that is fundamentally the starting point, which is that in 2024, that's the reality in which we're living. And the question is, how do you manage that reality in a way which might not be perfect? No negotiation is going to be perfect for, it's not going to be perfect for Palestinians who maybe don't get the ultimate justice which historically they feel they deserve. There will be many Israelis who feel that it's a historical injustice that they probably lose that access to holy sites across the West Bank, which is actually biblical Israel. And there will be a reality that it will be an imperfect peace. I think, though, that there are other options on the table. So there is talk, and I'm not sure that this is the day after war or this is where you get to. But in the long term, things like confederation and two states in the form of confederation open up a world of possibilities about where people can physically move, where they can live. The idea that actually people can potentially continue to live in places where on paper they couldn't live now. So settlers that would be removed from the West Bank, Palestinians that wouldn't be able to return to their homes. There is a scenario in the long term in which there is potential for all those things to become possible in something like the Confederation. So much like you have in Europe, right? Which is that if you are French, you can go and reside in Germany as a French citizen. And it's possible that there are ways around this issue which are not perfect, but they create some ability to maneuver around something which appears intractable. I think, though, that I say that with quite a note of caution, which is that if you look at what is going on the ground today and you look at where Israelis and Palestinians are and how they view each other, I personally don't think that we're going to move from the state of war to that kind of imperfect peace in which people can freely move between borders, countries. I think we're quite far away from that right now.
Is the idea of a one state in which people can live side by side, regardless of religion, is that so far-fetched?
Well, I think there's multiple issues you have to consider, which is the polling of Israeli and Palestinian populations. And obviously, polling is very snapshot at a certain point in time, and what solution, they are prepared to accept will change depending on the circumstances. And there is definitely dwindling support for a two-state solution. Nevertheless, there has been plenty of polling that has showed that despite that very significant dwindling support, if a deal was actually on the table for two states, most people would support it. The issue with one state, I guess, to go back to my previous point, is that when you have two groups of people who claim national rights to a piece of territory, both of whom want to sing their own national anthem, both of whom want to raise a flag, both of whom want to effectively run their own independent countries, vote for their own governments, and it's not that they will be exclusively Jewish or Palestinian because those populations are mixed, but want to have that national representation. The idea that you can somehow end that national conflict in one state feels very, very unlikely. You're going to have a joint police force, a joint army, a joint judiciary. I mean, there is a judiciary in Arab, inside Israel today that has Palestinian Arab citizens of Israel that are part of it, but that's still quite different from a one state in which you have Palestinians and Israelis that are able to make a state function and all the arms of the state, given where we are today. So my view is that it's a very unlikely long-term outcome.
I spoke recently on this podcast to David Waring, who is an expert on Middle East relations at the University of Sussex. And although Rishi Sunak had claimed that the attacks by the Houthis in Yemen on shipping in the Red Sea was nothing to do with the Israel-Gaza conflict, he said that's absurd to claim that. And he said that the Houthis in Yemen, backed by Iran, are seeking to push back against Western influence in the region, make life difficult for the Western powers. And that's driven by a sense that the West, certainly the UK and the United States, have had far too much influence in the Middle East. Realistically, the state of Israel would not exist without support from both of those states. Is it feasible to imagine the UK and the US washing its hands of the region? Would that be a responsible thing to do? Is that something that they should do, given that we're thousands of miles away from this conflict?
I think it's highly unrealistic. The UK and the USA and, most of the Western world have very significant interests in the region in terms of their own threats to the West, that come particularly from Iran, but they have their own interests in terms of relationships with the Gulf states, relationships with Saudi Arabia. And I think that the idea that we can maintain, as the global West, maintain those relationships and just kind of put the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to bed and push it away and say, we're not having anything to do with that bit of the Middle East, I just think is unrealistic. And I think actually what this conflict, the last 4 months of this conflict have proved is kind of the exact opposite, which is that if the West wants to maintain a foot in the region with its allies, or even a foot in the region because it wants to contain its foes, you can't do that in isolation of Israel-Palestine. And I think what sometimes is missing a bit from the analysis of what's happened with the Houthis and what's happened with Hamas with Gaza is the extent to which that is backed by Iran. It's not completely homegrown. That resistance in Yemen and the resistance in Gaza is not homegrown. It's funded and it's fueled by an Iranian regime who sees the West as an enemy. And so, actually, how the Middle East configures around Israel-Palestine is very significant in our own relationships. And I think that in some respects, when the dust has settled on this incredibly awful episode in this conflict, there is actually an opportunity here to say the Middle East could be a much stronger and a much closer friend almost of America, of the UK, if we can resolve this conflict. That it's really clear that there are relationships developing in terms of trying to contain this conflict, which are actually really critical long term. So the fact, for example, that you have Qatar playing such a leading role in trying to negotiate with Hamas and negotiate the hostages out and negotiate with Israel, that's really significant. That's a complete realignment of the Middle East, that suddenly there are regional actors that are becoming incredibly influential and are sitting right at the center of this. And I think that there is a chance from where I'm sitting. The big thing now is how does the international community seize the chance that it has in the aftermath of this terrible war to say, we've got to end it once and for all. And we now have a whole load of other partners at the table that weren't there in the last round of violence, partly because of the Abraham Accords, partly because of emerging interests in places like Qatar, who can help end this. And we've got to seize the moment. That will not happen without the US and the UK.
One final thought. Israel is the Jewish state, but there are many Jews in Israel who disagree with the Israeli government, as you've talked about with the protests. There are many Jews in the United Kingdom who I'm sure feel very uncomfortable about Israel's reaction to the undeniable atrocities of October the 7th. This may be unfair. I'm asking you to speak personally about this now, but how do you view the conflict as a UK citizen with an understanding and an appreciation of the state of Israel? How does it make you feel at this moment?
I have spent over a decade of my life as a Jew working on this conflict. So Yaha, the organization that I run, exists to mobilize British Jews in support of resolving the conflict. So using whatever kind of power influence we have as British citizens, as part of a global Jewish community, to speak out in support of conflict resolution. And so I guess my starting point is that Jews outside of Israel have a role to play in this, and that we are stakeholders. Whether we like it or not, we are somewhere a cog in this very big machine that is turning. And I think for a long time, Jewish communities have seen their job and their role to be to support Israel. And actually, what I have been trying to do through the organization that I run is to actually mobilize British Jews in support of backing resolving the conflict, that Israel exists. It's not going anywhere. But in order for Israel to survive and thrive, for the Palestinian people to have freedom and dignity, and actually the world to be a safer and more secure place, we need the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to be resolved. And stakeholders outside the region, of which British Jews are one, and we're a relatively minor one, but we are still a stakeholder, have got to be part of finding the solution. Because if we're not part of finding the solution, there's a great chance that we are actually part of fueling the problem. And I guess I feel quite strongly that we need to put the Jewish community here to put us to work in being part of the solution. And I think that sometimes it becomes very tricky to navigate where those differences lie and where the lines are. And are Jewish communities advocating for Israel? Are they advocating for the Israeli government? Are they advocating for resolving the conflict? And it becomes difficult for the community internally to navigate it. And it absolutely becomes difficult for people outside the community to understand what is going on internally in the community. I think that my parents' generation as Jews and their parents saw the creation of Israel and the survival of Israel as the challenge of their generation as Jews. I feel that resolving the conflict between Israel and the Palestinian people is a kind of a necessary imperative morally and politically, and that that is the role of my generation of Jews, which is why I think that it's really important that the community is active in getting behind right now the push that people like Cameron are making to try and push the region onto a new path. Because if it doesn't happen now and we go back to some awful status quo that looks something like October the 5th or 6th, we're going to be back here again in 5 years' time, and we'll probably be back here and it will probably be even worse than it is now.
Hannah, thank you for your time. That's Hannah Weisfeld from Yachad. This has been the Byline Times podcast. And if you want to support our work, then head over to bylinetimes.com, and that will tell you how you can subscribe to the newspaper, the Byline Times. It's actually now a snazzy A4 periodical, available as well in selected newsstands. But the best way to support the podcast and support the newspaper, which contains original material you can't read anywhere else, and the best of our online offerings, is to take out a subscription. That's over at bylinetimes.com. This has been a We Bring Audio production made in Birmingham by me, Adrian Goldberg. We'll see you again very soon. Thanks for listening. Take care now. Bye-bye.